So those seem to be experiences. So we experience change, and we experience birth and death, and we experience actions and consequences, and we experience pain. Now the question becomes, how do we understand those things? Because there's a difference between an experience and an understanding of your experience. Right? They're not the same thing, although sometimes we conflate the two, and we think that however we think things are, that's the way they are. But more than one interpretation of anything is possible. Well, yes, more than one. Whether it's 2 or 5 or 3,000 is up for grabs, but at least more than one. So what happens is that some people begin to understand birth and death as cyclical, hence reincarnation or rebirth, because that was the time conception at the time. The time had a cyclical nature, not a linear progression that begins at some point and ends at some point, as we have in the West. And they understood actions and consequences as karma. But karma was a form of bondage. That is, once you acted in some way, consequences were inevitable and there was no way to break that chain. It was like a mechanical process. In other words, it acted like gravity acts. So you jump up. What happens next? You don't get to hover for a while. You come down. So actions have consequences. That was understood as inevitable, mechanical, and operated everywhere.
So no free will in that?
No free will.
No free will.
No free will. In fact, you can't find free will in Buddhism either. That's a Western concept. But we'll get to that. Some people find that distressing, but not necessarily. So actions and consequences, that's understood as bondage. Impermanence is a change. Impermanence is understood as unreliability. In other words, there's nothing upon which you can depend because things are going to change on you. And then pain is understood as suffering. And so if you look at those understandings, repetitive cycle of birth and death, unreliability, bondage, and suffering, that's samsara. So samsara, after about 200 years, is understood as a problem. So we have the problem of samsara. How do you solve the problem? Because as soon as you understand anything as a problem, then you might conclude, well, if there's a problem, there must be a solution. So about the time of the Buddha, the hunt is on for a solution. And the people who are seeking for the solution are known as renunciates, typically. Seekers, wanderers, renunciates, all of those terms kind of conflate. And the Buddha is one of those. Well, he's not the Buddha yet. He's Siddhartha, the prince who renounces his princely life and wanders off. So there were basically two solutions that ended up to the problem of samsara. One is the transcendental solution. That is, we experience these things, change and consequence and pain, and we experience these kinds of things, and we interpret them in a particular way, but they're not really real. It's an illusion. There's something acting behind the scenes. And that thing that was alleged to be acting behind the scenes was Brahman, the essence of all that existed, and everything else is the phenomena of experience. That's an illusion. It's not really what's going on. So those people basically tried to distance themselves from experience and phenomenal reality and retreat because the world wasn't real and it was just rejected. It doesn't seem as though the Buddha took that approach. It seems as though he was a naturalist. That is, phenomena are real, or at least appear to be real, and you need to take them as real. But that's very interesting because it seems as though he was the first naturalist thinker on the planet, or the first naturalist philosopher. Some people argue that he was, in fact, the first philosopher that ever existed. philosopher, religion, psychology, all the same thing at that point in time. So if you look back at who he was the first naturalist philosopher. He was the first naturalist ethicist, that he established a system of ethics that didn't appeal to anything transcendental or supernatural. And he was most likely the world's first psychologist, because his system of how it is that we should think about our internal processes was extremely sophisticated, still is. By modern standards, it still works, theoretically and practically. Otherwise, things that we were talking a little bit about last night, mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapies, those things work. And basically, he invented that stuff. Well, if you're a naturalist, which he seemed to be, because in philosophy, there's really only two kinds of philosophers, transcendentalists that think that something's acting behind the scenes, and naturalists that don't think anything's acting behind the scenes. Even scientists, when they look for something acting behind the scenes of molecules, there are atoms, and behind the scenes of atoms, there are subatomic particles, and behind that scene, quanta, or behind quarks and strings, and who knows what else is going on. But all those things are natural. We just have to keep looking for them. So it's not as if anything supernatural is acting behind the scenes. It's not as if anything transcendental is acting behind the scenes. Something natural is acting behind the scenes. But if you think that's the case, and it seemed as though the Buddha did, that means the phenomena of experience, that is your experiential reality, is to be taken as real. Now, whether it's actually real or not, that's a question that's not answerable. And it doesn't seem that he was interested in answering it, because he wasn't really interested in the natural world so much as he was interested in how we experience the natural world. Socrates, about 100 years later, comes to exactly the same conclusion. And he may have been influenced by Indian thought. In fact, there's a fair amount of evidence that he was, particularly Plato. Plato certainly was. Whether Socrates was or not is a little bit up for grabs, but Plato certainly was. Well, I shouldn't say certainly, because some Western philosophers don't even like going there, because they want to keep the priority of Greek culture as the first and preeminent culture on the planet, except the evidence really doesn't support that. And by the way, dependent production is not linear. It's non-linear. Things happen sort of everywhere. And this lecture is going to be a little bit like that. So I'm going to pull things from all sorts of places. And eventually, I hope it comes together in some sort of coherent piece. And if it seems to wander off in weird directions and you feel the need to bring me back to wherever, feel free. So let's take a look at phenomena. From the standpoint of the Buddha, it seemed, all phenomena were equal. That is, they all appeared to be equally real. So then why is it that we take sides? Because we all do. We decide that some phenomena are more important than other phenomena. But if all phenomena are equally real, what do we observe about all phenomena? Well, they arise and disappear, right? I mean, isn't that obvious to your experience? That shouldn't be a revelation. Not only humans know that, animals know that. You don't have to have a sophisticated intelligence like humans have to notice that things change. So phenomena arise and disappear. And as arising and disappearing, every phenomenon is equal to every other phenomenon, because they all have the characteristic of being impermanent. Now, some phenomena change more slowly or more rapidly than others. The Buddha in the sutras used three metaphors. One was the metaphor of food, one was the metaphor of fire, and the other was the metaphor of entanglement. So let's think about fire as a metaphor for impermanence. If everything's impermanent, that means everything's on fire, in effect. But some fires burn more slowly than other fires. So if you took a log, for example, and you set it outside in your backyard and lit it, you would notice the impermanence of that log occurring fairly rapidly, because in a short period of time, it would go from being a log to being ash. But if you took an iron bar and put it in your backyard, the same thing would eventually happen, right? It would turn to ash, because rust is going to decompose it. It's just more slow than fire. So it's the same process. Oxidation is a kind of combustion. It's just that in iron bars, it happens more slowly than in firewood. Diamonds are decomposing also, but very, very slowly. The window appears to be a solid, although some physicists think that glass is actually a very slow-moving liquid. But you can't see it moving. I can't see it moving. I'm not sure anybody could see it moving. But perhaps, if you had the right equipment, you could. So if everything's on fire and everything's burning, why does it make any sense to privilege some sorts of things that are burning over other sorts of things that are burning, since everything is burning? But in fact, that's what we do. So it seems to me that impermanence is really the core teaching of the Buddha. Everything follows from that. According to the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha's last words were, "All compounded things are subject to dissolution." But everything's a compounded thing, so that means everything's subject to dissolution. And you could probably assume that the last words of someone's mouth, particularly someone like the Buddha, was the most important thing he was going to leave with us. And that's what he left with us. Things are going to decay. So if things are going to decay and all phenomena are equal, then upon what grounds do we take sides? Assume some phenomena have a kind of priority that other phenomena don't have. We do it all the time. Everybody does it. But what's the rational grounds for it? What's the evidential grounds for it? And there doesn't really seem to be any. If everything's burning, then everything's in flux. Everything's changing. And what we try to do is hold things in place, fix things, not because they're broken, but because we want them to be stabilized. But nothing is stabilizable. Now, that doesn't mean that things are totally unpredictable. You know, when you walk out of this room and leave the chair that you're sitting in, it's not going to turn into a cabbage in the meantime, because things have a kind of trajectory that they're on, and they're going to change. But some things change very slowly and imperceptibly, and you're not going to notice it, so you can kind of depend upon it to be pretty much the way it was in the short term. In the long term, probably not so much. So if all phenomena are equal and everything changes, that means that nothing has any inherent identity at all. That whatever identity something has that we give to that something is for pragmatic purposes. We all identify this as a glass with water in it. If I identified it as a banana, you would think one of two things. Either he's delusional or doesn't know what the word banana means. He wouldn't think, oh, okay, it's a banana for him, it's a glass of water for everybody else, and think that somehow I wasn't mistaken. He would assume I made some sort of cognitive error or perceptual error, something went awry somewhere. So because we try to establish fixity, that is, stick the world when it can't be done, we suffer. Suffering is an attempt to take the world of change and make it stop. How do we do that? Well, we do that because we basically conjure things up. We create a world of fictions in our minds. Propenka, which means conceptual proliferations, and moha, which means confusion or wishful thinking, literally it means seeing through smoke. So if you were seeing through smoke, of course you wouldn't see very clearly. So the reason we suffer is because of either conceptual proliferations, wishful thinking, all sorts of things are going on. And if you don't want to suffer, you have to fix that. So when the Buddha comes back to actions and consequences, he thinks, well, they're not mechanical at all. They're intentional. So if you change the way you think, if you see unconfusedly, if you're not conjuring up a bunch of concepts, then you might see the world more clearly. In fact, you will see the world more clearly. Which brings us to, very quickly, but we'll get back around to those things, to the alleged no-self, which, to my way of understanding, is the most misunderstood of the three seals. The Buddha never said there was no self. The Buddha never said there was a self. Two examples. The wanderer, let's see if I get his name right, Vakugata, who's apparently wandering because he's confused. There's things he wants to know, and he can't find out the answer anywhere. So he's wandering all over the place trying to find the answers to things. And he comes upon the Buddha, and he asks the Buddha about the self. He says, is there a self? And the Buddha doesn't answer. He remains silent. And then Vakugata says, well, is there not a self? And the Buddha doesn't answer. So when asked very straightforwardly if there was such a thing or there wasn't such a thing, he doesn't answer. And Vakugata walks away because he didn't get an answer to his question. And then Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, says, well, why didn't you answer? And he says, well, Vakugata is confused. If I answered him one way or the other, he would have ended up more confused. Because if I said there was a self, he would have thought in terms of eternalism, that this self always existed. And if I said there wasn't a self, then he would have thought in terms of the way the skeptics and the materialists thought, that there isn't a self, so when your body died, you were extinguished. Now, if you think about those two things, the self is eternal, or the self disappears at death and is identical to the body. Are those really answerable questions? I mean, given the phenomena of experience, if you are looking at the phenomenal world, can you answer the question that anything is eternal? You really can't. Phenomena don't appear to be eternal. That's a transcendental move. What you're saying is, there's something acting behind the scenes, and I want something to be eternal, so there must be something that's eternal. The Buddha was far too clear a thinker to make that move. But then there were at the time they were known as Charvakian materialists. And the Charvakians thought that the body and the mind and the self are all identical. It's a lot like what scientific materialists think these days. But that's an unanswerable question. We don't know that the body and the mind are identical. We don't know that. Neuroscientists assume that, but that's a metaphysical assumption. They can't know that. They try to make a move to something known as the neural correlates of consciousness, but they can't find any. So you're talking about the neural correlates of consciousness, and you can't find any neural correlates. What makes you think there are any? We don't know that for sure. So that's another, at this point at least, unanswerable question. So the Buddha was sort of reluctant to answer unanswerable questions. So what did he do when he didn't answer that question? He was actually treating the question psychologically. In other words, here's this poor wanderer. The man is utterly confused and doesn't know how to operate in the world. No matter what I do, I'm going to make him more confused. So apparently, his reluctance to answer the question is psychological, or it's for psychological reasons, that some questions are not conducive to tranquility. They're just conducive to more vexation. Why even go there? There's another thing that he said that sort of refers to this phenomenon of the alleged no-self. And that is, he says, and I can't remember the scripture, so I apologize for that, where he says, those who discern the things of the world with wisdom and truth, those who discern the things of the world with wisdom and truth know that it cannot be said that things either are or are not. So that is, such and such a thing is, or such and such a thing is not. Those two ways of looking at things don't apply to how things actually are. Because if you say something is not, you sort of fix it in time and space. But that violates impermanence. Things are not fixed in time and space. And if you say something is, you're doing the same thing. Now this gets really troubling for Western philosophers. Because Aristotle thought that he came up with the laws of thought. Aristotle, the laws of thought. Identity, A is A and not A. Non-contradiction, things cannot be both A and not A at the same time. So Aristotle divided up the world between A and not A, is and is not. And those were the laws of thought. And what the Buddha is basically saying is that reality cannot be bounded by the laws of thought, that reality is actually more complicated than that. In order to experience reality the way reality actually is, if you bind yourself to the laws of thought, you're not going to experience reality the way it is. Quantum physicists pretty much know this at this point in time, because the quantum field doesn't seem to work that way, where something is or isn't. Maybe some of you know about Heisenberg's indeterminacy principle, where if you know where something is, you don't know where it's going, and if you know where it's going, you don't know where it is. So that's kind of an is-is-not kind of deal. So reality at its deepest level can't be fixed by the laws of thought. We can experience it, but the laws of thought can't really account for it very well. And the Buddha had that insight 2,600 years ago. Wasn't the only person with that insight, but he was probably the first person with that insight. Lao Tzu in China had the same insight. Roughly at about the same time. So if it's the case that we can't say what the self is or isn't, that means that saying something about the self is psychologically problematic because it just causes vexation and confusion. It's conceptually problematic because we're trying to fix it in some way in our thought processes when it really can't be done. And it's problematic, philosophers would call it ontologically. That is, ontology is the study of a thing. So when you talk about it as a thing, it's problematic as a thing because we don't know what kind of thing it is or if it's even a thing at all. It seems to occur, and it seems to hang around for a while. And if you pay close attention, it's going to seem to disappear, but it's not going to disappear as in wink out of existence. It's going to change enough so that it, well, it's not quite the same as it was. Now, how fast that's moving, well, that depends a little bit on your perception.
Can I ask you something? Still, sure. So the question to the Buddha about the confused wanderer about the self, what would have been a definition of self that Ananda would have heard, for example, and said, okay, I think I understand what question he's asking. I mean, we think of self a certain way today, and I'm confused about how we think of it today, but would it have been a similar
Self is like everything. Let's go back to, this is going to be a long-winded way of answering your question, but bear with me. Let's go back to samsara. When you have samsara, you have birth and death, actions and consequences, karma, bondage, impermanence, and pain and suffering. How do you explain those things? Well, you could say they're just an illusion. They're not really real. Only Brahman is real, and this sort of essential self is real, and all of that stuff's an illusion. Or you can say, well, each has a different explanation. That was a move a lot of people made, and some of the Ajivaka skeptics thought, well, there isn't any explanation. Any explanation is countered by some other explanation. They were basically skeptical relativists. They thought, well, you know, you have your opinion, I have my opinion, your opinion is as good as my opinion. Clearly the Buddha didn't think that. What he did was take all of, and samsara was considered to be existence itself. And he explained existence itself by dependent production. So he took everything in existence and explained it one way. If you think about it, that's genius. Geniuses do that. They take everything that we experience and say, here's just one explanation for all of this. It's kind of like what Einstein did. Took the whole world of physics and explained it in E equals MC squared. Not that I have any idea what that actually means. Maybe some of you do. But if you take the whole of existence and say, well, there's one explanation for it. So what's the explanation for the self? It's dependently produced. And you have to understand the factors of dependent production. If you don't understand that, you don't understand yourself, and you don't understand reality. Any other understanding other than dependent arising, dependent production, dependent co-arising, dependent origination, all the same thing. If you don't understand that, you don't understand reality correctly. And if you don't understand reality correctly, you're going to make basic mistakes. And if you keep making basic mistakes repetitively, you will suffer. So impermanence and not understanding the impermanent nature of things will cause you to suffer. Suffering will cause you to suffer. Pain causes you to suffer. Suffering causes you to suffer. Did you ever get sick? I mean, sort of really sort of sick and get upset that you were sick? Isn't that kind of extra? Why don't you just be sick? The world creates pain. You create suffering. in the scriptures, the Buddha talks about two arrows, or two darts. Pain is one dart. The world is going to give you pain. There's no way to escape that. We're kind of wired for pain. Modern social science is that it takes five pleasant experiences to overcome one unpleasant experience. So you go to work, right? And how many of you get up for work because the alarm went off? Okay, the alarm went off. That means you really wanted to sleep more, right? So now you get up. That's an unpleasant experience. You're getting up before you really want to. Now you need five pleasant experiences to overcome that one pleasant. You're already at a deficit of five. And then you burn the toast, yeah. And now you're at 10. See, you're just kind of... which makes life kind of problematic. But being upset about unpleasant experiences is what you do to yourself. That's that second arrow kind of thing. So if you understand the world in the way the Buddha would like you to understand yourself, you realize that there will be pain. It's inevitable. We're wired for it. Can't survive without it. But suffering, well, that's a choice. That's an option. You don't have to suffer, but you have to experience pain. You have to. There's no way out of that one. Just like you have to experience impermanence, but it doesn't have to be a cause for regret. Things change. You have to experience the consequences of actions. That's just built into the system. But it doesn't have to be bondage for you. Think of it like being out in the ocean, where there are large waves. Well, some people surf on large waves, and some people drown because of them. They're in the same water, and they're dealing with the same waves. Some people drown, some people surf. You're probably better off surfing. Right? That kind of makes some sense. So if you understand how the nature of things, in fact, is dependently produced and what all those factors are, then you can sort of disentangle yourself from the adverse consequences of impermanence and pain so that there really isn't suffering, but there is pain. Suffering's an option, as I said. And realizing that the self is dependently produced, and if you understand the nature of dependent production and how it produces the kind of self it produces, then you can enter into that process, because one of the aggregates is consciousness, and consciousness enables you to be aware of, attend to. That's what he meant by consciousness. He didn't mean consciousness with a capital C as an independently existing factor like the Upanishads did and Plato did and Plotinus did and a lot of Western mystics do. The Buddha didn't think of consciousness with a capital C. He thought of it just, it's just another aggregate. It's an important one, but it's just another aggregate, small c. He meant awareness of, which is a lot how modern neuroscientists think of consciousness. They don't think of it as something with a capital C. They think of it as awareness of or attending to. But I had that figured out 2,600 years ago. So if you are conscious and know what's going on as dependent production sort of unfolds, then you could enter into that process and, well, unravel it. So I mentioned that the Buddha thought in terms of three basic metaphors: fire and food and entanglement. I did mention that, yes? Thank you. Because sometimes I don't pay attention to myself and I'm not sure what I said. So, why fire and why food? Why did he come up with those kinds of things? Well, once again, the Buddha didn't appear in a historical vacuum. The culture of the time thought the Sanatana Dharma means the everlasting order, the everlasting reality. It was the basic orientation of Hindu culture at the time, and still is. The gods had it as part of their function to keep reality going. Brahma creates it, Vishnu sustains it, Shiva dissolves it. But as long as we want reality to keep on going, the gods, who are not all-powerful, need some help. So how do you help the gods? The fire sacrifice. So you take fire and you offer food for the gods. Maybe it's a plant offering, or maybe it's an animal offering. It's the burnt sacrifice kind of thing that, if you're familiar with biblical scripture, Cain and Abel got involved in, and that was one of the reasons why things went horribly awry. So we're going to feed the gods. Feeding the gods sustains the gods, and sustaining the gods keeps reality going. But you sustain the gods by, one, feeding them, and two, using fire. So those kinds of imageries, feeding and fire, were extremely important in Indian culture at the time. And the Buddha takes a look at them and says, okay, let's take a look at feeding. So you're hungry, right? And you eat. That's satisfying, right? Does that mean you're never going to eat again? Of course not. So there's something ultimately unsatisfying about the phenomenon of eating, because you have to keep doing it. Over and over again, you're going to feel dissatisfied in order to feel satisfied. And that's a lot like life. We feel dissatisfied, and then we satisfy ourselves in the hopes that such satisfaction is permanent, but it never is, and it can't be. So now we're stuck in this endless feeding cycle. So we're always feeding things. And the example of physical feeding pales in comparison to sensuality feeding, and habit and practice feeding, and view feeding, and falling in love with ourselves feeding. And we're just feeding this stuff all the time in the hopes that we don't have to keep feeding it and that we won't get hungry again, but we always do. And then there's fire. Fire is really interesting, because for the Hindu culture at the time, fire is extremely important. Fire is this wonderful thing. Fire enables reality to be sustained, because you give sustenance to the gods. But over the course of time, it was understood that external fire was not as good as internal fire. So the use of fire was in what was known as the fire sacrifice. So there came to be a time when Hindu culture thought about internalizing the fire sacrifice. That is, you generate your own heat. You do hot yoga, right? Anybody familiar with hot yoga? How does hot yoga get hot?
It's hot in the room.
It's hot in the room.
Outside in.
See, that's a total dumbing down of what Hindu culture thought in the first place. The room doesn't give you heat. You generate it yourself. That is, there were techniques where you generated your own bodily heat, and that was assumed to burn things internally such that you would use that heat to feed the gods. So you yourself became a conduit for sustaining the gods, which is pretty grandiose if you think about it. Hot yoga is like, I think the ancient Indians would think, really? You need a hot room to do this? Come on, guys. What the Buddha does, see, feeding and fire are good things. And the Buddha comes along and says, no, they're not. they're really bad things. So he flips this whole thing right on his head. What you think is good is actually not good. Feeding is not good. Now, of course, you're thinking, well, of course, I got to eat. Well, of course you do. But think about the things that you might be feeding that really aren't in your best interest. I mean, we feed greed all the time and hatred all the time and delusion all the time. Just look at modern culture for all the feeding we do of those things. So we'd be better off if you let those things starve. That would be better. And fire. Well, in the, it's called the fire sermon. You've probably heard of the fire sermon. But that's what the British decided to call it because they thought the Buddha was just some sort of preacher. Well, the Buddha isn't a preacher. He's a teacher. Teachers are not preachers. Preachers don't invite any objections to what they have to say. They're speaking to the already converted. But teachers are presenting a point of view, and as the Buddha says in the Mahakamala Sutra, don't believe what I say. Test it out. Don't trust authority. Don't trust people who have X or Y reputation. Find out what they have to say. Test it out for yourself. See if it works. But that's what teachers do. They invite objection. Preachers don't invite objection. So in the fire teaching, the Buddha says, the mind is on fire with the fire of selfishness, ill will, and delusion. The eye is on fire with the fire of greed, hatred, and ignorance. And he just goes on and on, listing body parts and, well, basically lists the aggregates and says they're all on fire. Well, if you're on fire, what do you want to do? Well, you want to extinguish the fire, right? So where Hindu culture thought that fire was a really good thing, the Buddha thinks it's not really a good thing at all. It's actually a very bad thing. So nirvana, one way of translating nirvana, the word vana means fire, by the way, and nir means without. So without fires, but that's the fire teaching. You want to be without fires. You're not going to feed the flames of selfishness, ill will, and delusion. Well, okay, easy to say. Not all that easy to do. In order to know what not to feed and to know what to extinguish, you really have to know how things work. That's dependent production. So the self, once again, as I said, it was a long-winded way of getting around to the self. The self isn't an entity at all. The self is a dependently produced process. It neither is nor isn't. I mean, if you look at any process at all, if it's a process, you can't fix it in space or time, because then you'd stop the process. And it wouldn't be a process once you stopped it. You would terminate the process, and then you would annihilate it. But the Buddha, I'm sure all of you are familiar with the middle way sort of teaching, and the typical analogy is that the Buddha said a life of self-indulgence is low, vulgar, worldly, and spiritual and probably useless. A life of self-mortification is likewise low, vulgar, worldly, and spiritual and profitable and useless. So you think, well, self-indulgence, self-mortification, you want to get in the middle of that somehow. But eternalism and annihilationism are also extremes. That is, something exists permanently, whatever exists is going to be wiped out of existence and not exist at all. There's a middle way there. And the middle way is, see, if something's eternal, it's got to be unchanging. That was the insight that the Upanishads had. Parmenides had the same one. Plato agrees that the phenomenal world of change doesn't really exist. You're not supposed to take it seriously at all. There's just this unchanging thing. On the other hand, if there isn't this unchanging thing, then the world of phenomena is just going to rise and disappear and ultimately disappear and wink out of existence. And the Buddha presents us with the middle way. He says, well, neither of those things are quite true. Things are a process. Some processes are very fast, and you can watch them deteriorate right before your very eyes. And some processes are very slow, and some processes are in the middle, and you just need to pay attention to how the process works. Nothing's eternal. Nothing is free of dependent production, hence no free will. Can't be free will if everything's dependently produced. Everything depends on something else, which means nothing's free. Make sense? We like free will. Western culture loves free will. Why'd the concept even arise? What do you need it for? Have any idea?
Your salvation. To choose your salvation.
You choose your salvation. And why do you need to choose your salvation?
It reinforces my own importance.
Pardon me?
It reinforces my own importance.
Well, it does that, but to think of it theologically, I mean, where did it come from? I mean, it comes from Western religion. Free will is necessary to take God off the hook for misery and catastrophe. I mean, if God is responsible, here's Epicurus, about 2,300 years ago. If the gods can stop catastrophe, why don't they? If they can't, why worship them? Well, one way to solve that problem is to say, well, there's free will. The gods don't cause catastrophe. You do. It's your fault. But if you think about free will, what's it free of or from? Where does the freedom even come from? I'm pretty sure the Buddha thought there was will. Or more likely, there really isn't will. There's more like won't. So you sort of have free won't. You don't really have free will. In other words, you can enter into the processes of dependent production and say, no, I'm not going to do that. Willing is harder because if you look at dependent production, ignorance, fabrication, consciousness, sense media all arise before you make any contact with anything. So when you make contact with something, then perhaps you could will something about it. But there's four conditions that take place prior to any willing whatsoever. So it doesn't look like free will makes any sense from the standpoint of Buddhism, but from the standpoint of the teaching of the Buddha. That's probably another thing I should mention. The teaching of the Buddha seems to be one thing and Buddhism seems to be another thing. Because there are lots of forms of Buddhism, and many of them, I think if the Buddha was around, he would say, I never said that. I don't think that's right.
Does the notion of liberation go back to the Buddha, or just to one of the schools of the Buddha, would you say? Because I'm thinking liberation and freedom having relationship and meaning.
Well,
and
moksha,
yeah,
liberation, is typically understood as freedom from and freedom to psychologically, whereas liberty is typically understood as freedom from and freedom to socially. So you look at the first 10 amendments to the Constitution of the United States, you are free from illegal search and seizure. Well, you used to be. You are free to keep and bear arms. So if you just look at the first 10 amendments, you're free to do something, you're free from some other things. And it was typically understood in the Western analysis of that concept that the West specialized in social freedom from and social freedom to. But if you look at the history of Greek culture, that's not true at all. Socrates was interested in something more like liberation. He thought you could do it by the ordeal by reason. Plato thought you could do it by detachment. So did Epictetus and so did Epicurus, but they were probably influenced by Indian culture. And if you look at Indian culture and think, well, they're really interested in psychological liberation, but the Buddha, in creating the Sangha, that was a social liberation movement. I mean, he changed the whole landscape of India by saying, you know these untouchables here? They can do what the priests can do. You know these women here? They could attain nirvana too. I mean, that totally undermined the social system of Indian culture. I mean, the Buddha was a social revolutionary. We may think of him as espousing psychological liberation, but his point of view and the creation of the Sangha in the first place is a form of social revolution that's equal to anything that's ever been done in Western culture, and nicely didn't spill a drop of blood doing it. You could probably search in vain in Western culture for social revolutions that didn't spill any blood. We're kind of a bloodthirsty culture. It's not the Greeks' fault, it's really the Europeans, but that's different. Greek philosophy, European philosophy, not the same thing. Western philosophers like to say they're the same, there's a continuity there, but there's a real gap between the two of them. So, I'm not sure I even answered your question.
So is the liberated person free? Was that...
Is the liberated person free?
In terms of how they act?
Well, the liberated person is free from some things and free to do something else. So if there is nirvana, the liberated person is free from selfishness, is free from ill will, is free from ignorance, but is not free from the laws of cause and effect. If you jump up, you're coming down, whether you're liberated or not. If I put a 9mm handgun to your head and fire 6 shots, you're dead, whether you're liberated or not. I mean, there's still the laws of cause and effect. So it would be a mistake. And there are, you know, there are powers that people allege to have. Cities. Familiar with cities? Anyone? Powers. Clairvoyance, clairaudience, knowledge of past lives, flight, levitation, these kinds of things. And a lot of people make a big deal out of cities. The Buddha did not. He thought they were actually an impediment. If you had these kinds of powers, it was just a trap for your ego so that you would think that you were something special and nobody could do what you can do. And he really advised against the pursuit of them. So what's the liberated person free from? Basically selfishness, ill will, and delusion. Greed, hatred, ignorance, however you want to.
But if I do that, and the liberated person does that, is there a difference in the conditioning?
Well, you're both doing that. So as far as doing that is concerned, you're both doing that. Am I privy to the psychological state that allowed you to do that and some other person to do that? No. So I don't know what your psychological state is. It's a very Zen sort of question.
Well, it's not free will in the sense that maybe that it's being asked in today's Western sort of the materialistic view that there's no free will because quantum physics doesn't affect the macro world, and it all started at the Big Bang, and it's following its course, and it can never change. I mean, this is something, you know, that's not really a psychological view.
Okay, so when you do that, what happened?
I did that.
Well, is that actually correct? Did you do that? Because what we know from neuroscience is before you did this, before you thought to do that, your motor cortex was already in play. And it was activated. The neurological system that gets you to do that was already in place before you did that, and before you even thought to do that. So when you do that, you didn't will to do that because the functioning of your nervous system was already in place 0.025 of a second before you decided to do that. So where's free will?
So it sounds like the issue or the question of free will was the same today as it was then primarily. That's what I'm trying to get at. Are we talking about two different things, how the Buddhist time would have thought about freedom and free will?
Well, the Buddha never thought about free will. Okay. It wasn't a concept. that's a concept that arises because of monotheism. Okay. There wasn't any monotheism at the time. The Hindu culture at the time never thought in terms of monotheism. There were many gods, or there was one thing, monism, but there was no monotheism. They never made a pit stop at monotheism. And free will seems to be a necessity for monotheism. It doesn't seem to be a necessity anyplace else, but we're so conditioned to think about freedom in terms of free will that we appropriate this monotheistic concept and try to attribute it to places where it really doesn't belong. It doesn't belong in Buddhism. Nobody at the time thought in terms of free will. They thought in terms of illusion, because there's this transcendental thing going on, or they were skeptical about any conclusions that you could even come to, or they were confused, like Vakugatha, or, well, there was the Buddha solution. Things are interdependent and interconnected, independently produced, but no free anythings. Why don't we take a short break, and we'll do some more. Thank you.
Thanks.